people's face. The K is for the kill, M is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, or no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish it didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Bukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Less than a week after Israel launched a military assault on a flotilla of six civilian ships carrying humanitarian aid to Palestinians living in Gaza, which resulted in the deaths of nine passengers, the Israeli Navy intercepted another cargo ship challenging its three-year-old blockade of Gaza. The ship of Irish registry, the Rachel Corrie, was named after a U.S. activist killed by an Israeli bulldozer when she attempted to prevent the destruction of a Palestinian home in 2003. The vessel was boarded without reports of violence and brought to the Israeli port of Ashdod. Israel said the humanitarian aid on board the 1,200-ton cargo ship would be inspected and items not banned would be transported by truck to Gaza. Among the passengers on board the Rachel Corrie were Irish citizens Mairead McGuire, who won a Nobel Peace Prize for her advocacy of a peaceful settlement in Northern Ireland, and Dennis Halliday, a former UN humanitarian aid coordinator in Iraq, who resigned in protest over the imposition of economic sanctions on Iraqi civilians. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is now attempting to convene an international body to investigate Israel's May 31st assault on the six aid ships and the circumstances surrounding the deaths of nine passengers on the largest ship, the Mavi Marmara. Former U.S. Ambassador to Mauritania Edward Peck was among those on board the Greek-flagged boat Sfidoni, one of the other five ships intercepted by the Israelis. Peck is a 32-year veteran of the U.S. Foreign Service who was President Reagan's deputy director of the White House Task Force on Terrorism. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ambassador Peck about why he participated in the aid flotilla, accusations by Israel that the passengers on the aid ships had links to terrorists, and the reasons behind the growing international movement challenging Israel's Gaza blockade.
The whole flotilla was a European organized thing, as you may have noted. There were some 30-plus organizations from 30-plus countries that put this thing together. And at the last minute, they said we should have an American group. So they contacted an organization based in the San Francisco Bay Area called the Free Palestine Movement. And they said, okay, we can get a couple of slots for your people. And they called me, and I had never had any dealings with those interesting people before. And they said, would you like to go? Would you will be willing to go? And I thought about it, and I said, okay, all these years I've been talking about the Middle East and meeting people and bringing people together and explaining and listening, and maybe it's time to do something of a little more concrete nature. And that's why I went. My objective, you know, I could certainly not stand up and say what anybody else was thinking about. My objective was twofold. One was, of course, to get the humanitarian goods into that savagely attacked and partially destroyed area, which was suffering a really severe blockade on land and sea, which I thought would be a nice humanitarian act. And secondly, a certain amount of naivety here, and I'll admit it, even after all these years, I thought that here's a chance for Israel to say, okay, come in with that material. You people stay out because they don't need people there in Gaza drinking their water and eating their food, and come across as a bunch of good guys. And I was savagely mistaken on the second part, because our friend Israel prefers to use the mailed fist and the heavy hammer in efforts to advance its foreign policies in the region, and that's what they did. My principal reaction, seriously, when I open my eyes and here are these guys already on board our boat, because all they had to do was to step from the deck of theirs to the deck of ours, it's a small little 30-meter boat, was disappointment. Oh, my. Never dreaming that on the bigger one, the people would try to defend their ship and wind up getting killed.
On the ship you were in, I had read accounts that people tried to keep the Israeli commandos that boarded the ship out of the wheelhouse to prevent them from commandeering the boat and bringing it to the Israeli port of Ashdod.
Right. I was on the second deck down. There are three decks on that ship, really. I was in the middle deck, and it was all over because they just walked in the door, and there they were on the upper deck where the wheelhouse is. The people tried to offer what is called passive resistance, where you lock arms and get in the way. And the Israeli commandos didn't like that, so they broke some windows and used some stun grenades, and they hurt a bunch of people getting them out of there, so that when the ship finally docked in Ashdod, the first group of people to get off were the injured. One on crutches, several with their arms in slings, one man with a neck brace, bandages on the head, this sort of thing, plus other wounds that you couldn't see. Nothing serious, but they got pretty badly roughed up. The little group that I was with, we just sat there and stared at the gun muzzles.
Ambassador Peck, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in reaction to worldwide protests against the Israeli assault on these aid vessels, has claimed that some of the passengers aboard the aid flotilla and the Mavi Marmara, the ship where the violent clashes took place and the nine passengers were killed, Netanyahu says that some of these passengers had links to terrorists. How do you react to that?
Well, you know, I have to ask this question. What is it that we expected Mr. Netanyahu to say, that the boat was filled with tree-hugging pacifists? You know, it's called, in American politics, that's called smearing the opposition, you know. But were there some people like that? I don't know. But the intent, there were no weapons on the ship. That's why they had to use, you know, ship's rails that they tore loose and a couple of deck chairs, as I recall. But of course he said that. It would be similar to us saying on this side of the issue that those commandos can only be assigned to the Union if they're committed rapists or child molesters. Now, there may be some people in the commandos who fit that description. I have no idea. But once you do that, you change the whole level of the dialogue into, yes, I did, no, I didn't.
Ambassador Peck, it seems that the Israelis, in terms of world opinion, have suffered a lot of ill will, given that they're accused widely of disproportionate responses to the threats they confront. And we can look at everything from the death of Rachel Corrie, an American activist who sat down in front of a bulldozer and was killed in a military operation to destroy a Palestinian home, to the 2006 Lebanese invasion, to the recent invasion of Gaza, to this military operation on the ships that you were on. It seems that there's a psychology at work in Israel that they have to be as tough or brutal as possible. From a political perspective, that just doesn't seem to make sense in terms of their long-term welfare as a state.
Well, I would certainly agree with you, but you know, one of the things that's interesting is that Israel has always said, both the civilians and the army, that if you provoke us, our response is going to be disproportional. And certainly that has been the case in so many instances in which there seems to be the belief that to which you refer and which I recognize, that if we really savagely respond, they won't do it again. Well, that doesn't work in a situation in which people are motivated by belief that they have been mistreated or, you know, have had bad things, unacceptable things happen to them. That generates more. And I find this so unfortunate because in my own case, you know, and I stress this, I don't want anything bad to happen to one Israeli, but I am very much afraid that what is going on is going to hurt Israelis and Americans, and it already has.
That was former U.S. Ambassador to Mauritania Edward Peck, who was among those on board the Greek-flagged boat Sfidoni, one of six ships intercepted by the Israeli military on May 31st. For more information on the Free Gaza Movement, one of the groups coordinating the Gaza Aid ships, visit their website at freegaza.org.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, June 10th, 2010. Fifty boats to join the next Gaza aid flotilla, and Iran is set to sail two boats to Gaza. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Yasser Kashlak, the head of the Free Palestine Movement, announced Thursday that Freedom Flotilla 2 could include up to 50 ships. Kashlak said that a ship organized by Journalists Without Borders will depart from Lebanon to Gaza within a week. There will be journalists, members of the Free Palestine Movement, and other peace activists aboard the ship. In the meantime, two Iranian boats are expected to set sail to Gaza soon. Abdul Rauf Adibzadeh, head of the Iranian Red Crescent's International Relations Department, announced Wednesday that two Iranian ships carrying humanitarian supplies will be sailing to Gaza by the end of this week. Zadeh stated that the Red Crescent decided to send the two ships after Israel's deadly assault on the Freedom Flotilla, which claimed the lives of nine passengers. He also said that the first ship carries humanitarian supplies, while the second carries relief supplies to the Palestinian Red Crescent Society. The Rafah border terminal between Gaza and Egypt will remain open in order to enable the transfer of humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip, Dr. Mufid Shihab, an Egyptian official, announced. Shihab stated that these are the orders of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and added that Egypt will not abandon the Palestinian people until they achieve their legitimate demand of an independent state. He also said that the Palestinians will be allowed to leave Gaza and return to it through the terminal. U.S. President Barack Obama announced that his administration had decided to give $400 million to the Gaza Strip in order to build schools and provide housing. The statement came shortly after Obama's meeting with the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Washington. Obama said that his administration believes in improving the living conditions of the Palestinian people and added that the current situation in Gaza cannot continue as more positive stances are needed. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You've been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For constant updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by George Schmel. Welcome to This Week in Palestine, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for June 4th to the 11th, 2010. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas meets the U.S. President Barack Obama and discuss the Gaza siege. At the same time, Israeli attacks and raids into Palestinian communities continue in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with the nonviolent activities in Bethlehem and Ramallah in the West Bank. Residents of the village of Na'aleen organized an anti-wall demonstration after the Friday prayer today. Protesters marched from the mosque to the land slated for confiscation, despite the Israeli decision, which declared the villagers' land a closed military zone. Protesters carried Palestinian flags in addition to Turkish flags, as well as flags of countries of those who participated in the recent Gaza Freedom Flotilla. Israeli troops attacked the protesters with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets, while settlers from the illegal settlement of Hashmonaim gathered in the area chanting slogans that called for moving Palestinians to Jordan. The slogans also implied that all forms of Palestinian resistance are terrorism. A number of Palestinian protesters choked as a result of tear gas inhalation and were treated by field medics. In the village of Wad Rahal near Bethlehem, international supporters joined the farmers after the midday prayers in the local mosque and marched to the lands taken over by Israeli military for the apartheid wall construction. Israeli soldiers stopped the marchers from reaching the construction site. Organizers delivered speeches demanding the halt of illegal settlements and wall construction in the West Bank. The march this week ended without any clashes with the military. At the same time, another anti-wall protest was organized in the nearby village of Al-Masara. Israeli and international supporters marched with the villagers to their lands. Soldiers stopped the people near the settler road number 60, which separates the villagers from their lands. Soldiers used barbed wire to block the road for the protesters. At the military roadblock, local youth torched an Israeli flag. Troops arrested Hassan Brajia, a local organizer, after part of the burnt flag stuck into his shoes. While trying to shake it off, it hit a soldier's foot, resulting in his arrest, witnesses told Palestine News Network. Israeli and international supporters also joined weekly protests against the wall in the village of Belayin, central West Bank. Demonstrators in Belayin today formed their own Palestinian national football team, coinciding with the start of the World Cup, to highlight their right to be an independent nation. Shortly after the midday prayers, the players, together with dozens of other Palestinian, Israeli, and international activists, marched to the gate of the wall at the edge of the village where a goal was constructed and a game was begun. The gate separates the village from their lands. Several footballs were kicked over the fence onto the land owned by the village. Israeli soldiers responded to this entirely non-violent activity by firing volleys of tear gas at the participants. Soldiers then came through the fence and arrested six journalists, four of whom were soon released. Two, one Palestinian and one international, remain in detention. The tear gas canisters fired also caused large fires on the dry ground around the olive trees. Soldiers fired more canisters, directing their fire on the groups of villagers attempting to put out the resulting flames. The village of Belayin has been protesting the wall for the past 5 years. Last year, the Israeli High Court of Justice ordered the military to reroute the wall, giving the villagers half of the land the military took for constructing the wall. The military is yet to comply. In their meeting in Washington this week, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and U.S. President Barack Obama emphasized the need to find a solution for the Gaza Strip, which has been under Israeli blockade for the past 3 years. Meanwhile, European and Arab efforts to break the siege are underway. The details with IMEMC's Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
Barack Obama described the situation in Gaza as unsustainable and he pledged a sum of $400 million in aid to the Gaza Strip. Also, Obama called on Israel to work on easing the Gaza blockade. A part of their meeting, the two leaders voiced willingness to proceed with peace talks between Palestinians and Israelis. President Abbas maintained that there can be no real solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict without the occupied East Jerusalem. Abbas told the press that the international community and the United States recognize East Jerusalem as an occupied Palestinian territory and that should be a solution based on that fact. The Palestinian leader also stated that he can never deny the Jewish right to exist on the land of Palestine. The ruling Hamas party in Gaza criticized such remarks very sharply. In the meantime, European and Arab efforts are underway to ease the Gaza blockade. This week, Egyptian authorities reopened the Rafah crossing terminal after it has been closed for the past 3 years. Media reports suggested that those efforts would lead to reopening of at least one border crossing in Gaza regularly. Some Palestinian parties have rejected what they called partial solution for the blockade. They rather wanted comprehensive lifting of the siege. early next week, Secretary General of the League of Arab States, Amr Moussa, will be visiting the Gaza Strip within the same efforts and particularly bridging the gap between Fatah and Hamas for the best of national conciliation. Some commentators believe that the blockade cannot be eased or lifted without a national unity agreement between Fatah and Hamas. Rami Al-Mighari, IMEMC.org, Gaza.
During this week, Israeli forces killed 7 Palestinians and wounded 3 others in different parts of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The details with IMEMC's Catherine Miol.
The Israeli military raided at least 11 different locations in the West Bank and one in the Gaza Strip. These raids resulted in killing 7 Palestinians, 2 civilians, and 5 resistance fighters. During these raids, Israeli troops abducted 16 Palestinian civilians, including 4 children. They also abducted 6 human rights defenders, including 3 Israelis. Today at noon, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian man from the Wadi al-Jouz neighborhood of East Jerusalem. Israeli medical sources said Ziad al-Julani died of his wounds as he arrived at the hospital. Israeli sources said the troops opened fire at Ziad al-Julani when he refused to stop when ordered to do so by Israeli military police as they were setting up a checkpoint in the area. They also stated that he had tried to hit 2 policemen with his vehicle. In the process of shooting al-Julani, 5 others were injured, including 2 women, a senior citizen, and a child. Staying in Jerusalem, the Israeli authorities stripped 4 Palestinian residents of Jerusalem of their ID and residency rights, expelling them to other areas in the West Bank. The 4 are members of the Palestinian Parliament, representing the Change and Reform Bloc, affiliated with Hamas. All 4 have served some time in Israeli jails. They were arrested by Israeli police shortly following the capture of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit in Gaza. The Israeli decision to cancel their permanent residency rights to Jerusalem was based on accusations of, quote, breaking loyalty to the state, unquote, by being elected to the Palestinian parliament. Thursday, the magistrate's court in Haifa decided to keep 4 settlers, all yeshiva students, in custody. They are the main suspects in spraying racist graffiti on the walls of a mosque in Ibtin village near the central West Bank city of Ramallah. The incident occurred last Tuesday night. The Israeli Defense Council denied the charges, stating that there is no solid proof that could implicate the detained settlers and that the suspicions are only based on intelligence information. Israeli Ynet News reported that the charges included religious offense, conspiracy to commit a crime, and vandalism of property. The graffiti sprayed on the walls of the mosque read, "War will take place in Judea and Samaria," a reference to militarily occupied West Bank, and also marked for demolition. A Star of David was also drawn. In the Gaza Strip, Israeli forces shot and killed 4 Palestinian men diving underwater off the coast of Gaza. Palestinian media quoted sources of the Al-Aqsa Brigades, the armed wing of Fatah, as saying that members of the brigades were wearing diving gear as they were training in the sea nearly 1 kilometer away from the Al-Zahra beach, whereupon Israeli naval troops intercepted and fired at them. Israeli media quoted Israeli forces stating that the Israeli naval foiled an attempt of infiltration into Israel through the sea. For IMEMC.org, this is Catherine Neal.
And that was just some of the news from this week in Palestine. For more and constant updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This week's report has been brought to you by George Ishmael.
Daoud Nassar lives with his family on 100 acres on a hilltop outside Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank of Palestine. Although he has documentation dating back to the Ottoman Empire that his family owns the land, the State of Israel has been trying to claim it for 20 years, leading to a long, expensive legal battle. Because the Israelis have forbidden the construction of any new buildings on his property, Nassar founded a group called Tent of Nations and set up several large tents to house Israeli, Palestinian, and international volunteers who come to tend the land and be a focus of nonviolent resistance to Israeli occupation. With the financial support of a group of Americans, Nassar travels to the U.S. twice a year to speak around the country about his struggle to keep his family's land. The following excerpt of Nassar's talk was recorded on May 3rd at St. Patrick's St. Anthony Catholic Church in Hartford, Connecticut.
In 1991, we heard by chance that Israel declared our farm as a state land. Declaring it as a state land means that the land has no owner. We have the papers. But we went to the court, to the military court, and our lawyer presented the title for the land. Of course, it was not expected by the Israelis to have papers. So the case was postponed, but because of our location in the middle of a ring of Israeli settlements, they started to make it difficult for us to prove ownership. They said, well, we need to check out if your papers are for the right place. So we had to survey the land again. We had to bring eyewitnesses. We had to survey the land 7 times so far. And the legal battle started in 1991 and it is going on until today with a financial burden of $150,000. Of course, this is very difficult for us, but we thought we need to prove our ownership. We need to do it on the ground. We are facing many difficulties, like roadblocks. So we are our farm is being now disconnected from Bethlehem area. The other thing we are facing is the harassments of the Israeli settlers who came to uproot trees. They were threatening us with guns. They damaged our water tank. And they tried a couple of times to build a settlement on our land. Even the case was still in court and still in court. They are trying to put, you know, physical pressure on us in order to give up and leave. And they tried 3 times to build a road in order to establish a settlement. And the last, it was in 1997, 1998, 1999. And then in 2002, they came with big machines. They started working on our farm. We were not able to cross or to be near the settlers because we were scared that they will shoot at us. 3 days later, we managed to stop that road by court from the Supreme Court in Israel, and the settlers were very angry and they uprooted 250 olive trees from our property. It was very difficult for us, very difficult situation because we had the feeling we are alone in this struggle. But 3 weeks later, we received an email from a Jewish organization from England called European Jews for Just Peace in Palestine, and they sponsored 250 olive trees. They came and planted also these trees. It was a sign of hope, a sign of solidarity. Now we are still facing difficulties on the farm in terms of roadblocks, as I said before, and the biggest obstacle is the war. And this situation is bringing the Palestinians whether to react in a violent way or be passive and do nothing or migrate, you know, leaving the country. These are the three options that we see ourselves as Palestinians facing. Some people, they say, well, with violence we can achieve victory. Some people, they say, well, we have to wait for a superpower to come and for protection, for salvation. And some other people, among them are the best educated people and also Christians, they believe that there is no hope in that area. So why to bother ourselves and stay there? Why not to find another possibility to go outside and live there? We had a camp with teenagers, Palestinian children, last summer. And I asked the children, what are you planning to do after you finish school? They said, all of them, without any exception, 25 young people, they said, if we have an opportunity to leave, we will be leaving the country. For us, we said, we will never leave the area. We will never be passive people and sit down and cry and be the victims. And we said, we will never react in a violent way. We will resist in a non-violent way. And that's why we created a fourth option for us, which is called, we refuse to be enemies. And it is not easy to say this word, you know, because we are living in a situation where only we see the enemies. I know the Israelis as soldiers and radical settlers. They know us as radical Palestinians. Why? Because we are separated from each other. We don't know each other as faces. We don't know that among Israelis and Palestinians there are people who believe in justice, who believe in living together, and we believe in coexistence. And the idea is we want to resist the evil, not with evil. We want to resist the evil with good. And of course, this is a Christian way of non-violent resistance. So we created the Tent of Nations on our farm. And the idea, we said, we are not the victims. We are able to do something positive, even the situation is very hard.
That was Daoud Nassar of the group Tent of Nations. Since this talk, threats have escalated when on May 27th, Israeli officials ordered the demolition of 9 structures built without a government permit during the last 2 years. Nassar is now taking his fight to save his land to the Israeli Supreme Court. For more information, visit the website tentofnations.org or contact their American support group, Friends of Tent of Nations North America, at area code 301-320-0049 or through their website, fotonna.org.
Black Hawk down! Black Hawk down! A U.S. Black Hawk helicopter was shot down in Afghanistan Wednesday. 4 more U.S. soldiers were killed in a resulting crash. Reports suggest that an RPG-7 or similar rocket-propelled grenade was used, just like in Somalia, 1993. Afghanistan Wednesday. NATO is reporting the death of a British soldier in an IED attack in an undisclosed location. Pakistan, Tuesday night. Unknown gunmen burned 50 oil tankers and trucks parked in Tarnal on the outskirts of Islamabad with Molotov cocktails and gunfire. Every vehicle was completely destroyed. The Washington Post is reporting that U.S. military commanders fear they are running out of time in Marja, Afghanistan. In fact, we hear less and less about that Kandahar offensive that never seems to materialize, and instead we hear more and more about offensive after offensive by the Taliban. Iraq's been no piece of cake either.
Diyala Province, Iraq, today. CNN is reporting the deaths of 2 American soldiers in a suicide car bombing. 6 additional soldiers were wounded in the attack. 6 Iraqi civilians were killed and 22 others injured in this blast.
Diyala Province, Iraq, Thursday. A U.S. Army patrol was attacked by a roadside bomb in Mamal al-Tabuk, East al-Khalis region. Tikrit, Iraq, Thursday. 2 Sawa, or Awakening fighters, were killed, and 2 more were wounded by gunmen in the south of Tikrit, a police source reported on Wednesday. The home of a 3rd Sawa fighter was bombed, but no injuries were reported in that incident. The Sawa militias are former insurgents regarded by many as traitors for siding with U.S. occupation forces since 2007. Al-Anbar Province, Iraq, Thursday. A U.S. military vehicle was damaged on Thursday by a thermal bomb blast in Anbar, a U.S. Army source told Aswat al-Iraq News Agency. He did not specify the attack's location. Al-Anbar Province, Iraq, Thursday. 2 civilians were wounded on Thursday when gunmen blew up a cop's house in northern Fallujah, a police source told Aswat al-Iraq News Agency. Quote, the gunmen planted a number of explosive charges and amounts of TNT and C4 inside the house to destroy it. Mr. Barack Obama, does this really sound like a pair of wars you can win? Now's the time to throw in the towel and bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. You won't see me back there again.
During his first 18 months in office, President Obama has increased the use of unmanned drone attacks on suspected terrorists in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and other nations. The increase in the use of Predator drones is a strategy reportedly advocated by Vice President Joe Biden, but which has caused friction between Washington and both the Afghan and Pakistani governments. Supporters of the use of drones boast that these weapons have enabled the U.S. military and CIA to kill 34 out of the top 42 al-Qaeda operatives in Iraq. U.S. officials have also recently claimed that a drone attack killed Mustafa Abu al-Yazid, al-Qaeda's third-ranking operative in Pakistan. But in a report made to the United Nations Human Rights Council on June 3rd, Philip Alston, the UN's Special Representative on Extrajudicial Executions, called on the U.S. to use greater restraint in using unmanned drones to commit targeted assassinations of terrorism suspects beyond the war zones in Afghanistan. There is growing concern among international human rights activists and military officials that Washington's use of drones, based on a questionable legal foundation, could lead to a chaotic situation where dozens of nations carry out their own drone attacks across borders against individuals they label as terrorists. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jonathan Manis, legal fellow with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project. He explains why his group filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit in March to obtain the government's legal basis for drone attacks, the number of civilians killed, and the process of oversight and accountability for such attacks.
It appears that the president has authorized a program that permits the CIA to put the names of individuals on a list, a kill list, if you want to call it that, which I think would be fair. And the criteria that would get a person onto this list are unknown. They're secret. And obviously the evidence that would get a person onto the list are secret. And the entire program is operated with minimal oversight and accountability. So essentially the president's claiming the authority unilaterally to put the names of individuals, including U.S. citizens, I should say, on a list and to target them anywhere in the world that they might be found. It's hard to square that with the relevant human rights law. And in any case, if the president's going to engage in this kind of activity, it's extremely important that the public knows what its government is up to.
Jonathan, in a very public way, the Obama administration has admitted that the government has authorized an assassination by drone or other means to kill a U.S. citizen in Yemen, Anwar al-Awlaki, who is alleged to be connected to the Fort Hood shooting, as well as the failed Christmas Day underwear bomber from Nigeria and his failed attack on an airliner bound for Detroit. How do you respond to this escalation of the use of drones, not only to kill foreign terrorists, but actually U.S. citizens who may or may not be responsible for threats to this country?
Right. Well, I mean, it's extremely troubling that the program has been expanded to U.S. citizens. I mean, U.S. citizens don't lose their constitutional protections when they leave the borders of the United States. And again, U.S. citizen or not, outside of a zone where there is a war going on, where the rules that govern war properly apply, you can't kill a person unless they're... These are standards that are familiar from the domestic context. A police officer can't kill a person unless there's a imminent threat to life and the use of lethal force is necessary to prevent that. I suppose it may be possible that the government complies with those standards, but we have no indication that they do. And it's hard to square the idea that a person's name is put on a list after a sort of bureaucratic process in a sort of secret enclave of the government and that the name stays on that list for several months at a time. And then, presumably, when the person is found, you know, the government, you know, attempts to kill the person. It's hard to see how that would comply with this imminence requirement, and also with the requirement that it be, you know, a genuine last resort. So, if for example, if al-Awlaki could be captured, the government, I think, has an obligation to pursue that alternative.
There is a concern expressed by the UN representative on extrajudicial executions, Philip Alston, that the United States policy on these unmanned drone attacks could lead to dozens of nations launching their own cross-border drone attacks against individuals and groups that they label terrorists, just as the United States does. And the concern here is that there would be untold violence and chaos sown by what the United States is now doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. So the United States is still a leader in international law. So if the United States asserts that something is acceptable, other countries will feel quite free to do the same and then point to the United States' example as justification. So it seems that the principle that's being endorsed here is that when a country considers itself to be in a conflict against an armed group that's not sort of attached to any particular state, that it can use lethal force anywhere that it believes that a suspect is to be found. So it's not crazy to think that countries that we don't consider our allies could take the view that enemies of their state are located in countries that we're friendly with, and that they're entitled to use lethal force using drones or otherwise in those countries. So there's many countries out there with very sophisticated militaries, and drones apparently are not all that a complex a technology these days. So I think there's something like, I think you said, 40 countries which have developed unmanned aerial vehicles. And these countries, I think, are rapidly developing the capability to deploy missiles on these unmanned vehicles so that they could do just what the United States is doing. So it's really troubling, the idea that rules that govern war, I mean, the rules that govern war are intended to minimize harm to civilians, but really they recognize the fact that in war the objective is to kill the enemy. Now, if those rules govern anywhere in the world that a country believes a suspect might be found, that is an invitation to a sort of chaos. So we think it's extremely important. If the program is in fact more limited than it appears, the government should say so, so that we're not setting a dangerous precedent.
That was Jonathan Manis, legal fellow with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project. Contact the ACLU by calling area code 202-457-0800 or visit their website at aclu.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. People in the Gulf of Mexico, who have relied on fishing for generations, have had more than enough of BP's lies and more than enough of the oily words of members in Congress, and more than enough of talk of boots on BP's neck without BP ever seeming to choke. On Thursday, the 10th of June, Diane Wilson, a shrimper from Texas, showed up in a Senate energy hearing featuring Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski with a bottle of syrup that looks just like BP's oil. Senator Murkowski was blocking a bill to remove the cap on BP's liability for putting people out of work and BP's liability for cleaning up their own oily mess. As soon as she started speaking, Diane Wilson stood up, shouted her down, and poured what looked just like BP's own oily mess all over herself before being arrested.
No more lies, no blood fire.
What motivated you to cover your body with syrup?
Well, it's like I live in a very small fishing village right on the Texas Gulf Coast, and I have seen what is going on for years and years and years. But what is going on now is just like, it's unbelievable. It's like a nightmare. It's surreal. It's like your world is absolutely caving in around you, and I just could not stand and sit there and watch it and watch and read the papers daily about the analysis or what they think is going on or what they think they might do. And I was I have a contact with the fishermen in Louisiana, so I know what was going on there with them, and I I knew I had to personally do something because I felt my home was being destroyed right in front of me.
Since Action talks and BS walks, she chose to do something about all this.
Then once they let me in, I just sat there and waited. And I waited until she started talking, the senator from Alaska. And when she started talking, I stood up, totally interrupted her, and just started yelling. I said, I'm from the Gulf, and we are tired of getting dumped on. And we are so tired of it. And they just keep bringing it in, bringing more and more and more, and do more and more damage. And I said, we're not going to do it no more. And so I got that syrup, and I had it over my head, and I'd start pouring. I think there were two cops in the back, and they were grabbing me from the back, but I managed to pour it all over myself. My hair is still, I am, and when they hauled me off to jail, they confiscated my clothes for evidence, so they put me in this, like, a white a hazmat suit. It kind of looks like a big white garbage bag. So I'm still in my garbage bag, and my hair is glued to my head.
Hey, BP, you not only ruined hundreds of miles of coastline, possibly for centuries, you have single-handedly destroyed a huge fishing industry and maybe even the rest of the Gulf oil industry to boot. Hope you like paying lost wages to every fisherman and every oil man in the Gulf of Mexico, the next 100 years.
The ongoing BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is a daily outrage as oil and gas continues to foul the water, beaches, and wetlands. But in the oil-rich Niger Delta in West Africa, out-of-control oil leaks caused by rusting oil infrastructure are barely noticed. According to a study by the World Wildlife Federation and the World Conservation Union, over 1.5 million tons of crude oil have been spilled in the Niger Delta since the early 1970s, 50 times more than were spilled in the Exxon Valdez incident in Alaska in 1989. In early May, a ruptured ExxonMobil pipeline in Ikwa Ibom, Nigeria, spilled 1 million gallons of oil per day for a week before it was stopped. According to the Guardian newspaper, community leaders in the spill area are now seeking $1 billion in compensation for illnesses and lost income. Over the years, there have been over 2,000 major oil spills in the Niger Delta. Currently, Nigeria accounts for 40% of all U.S. oil imports and is the world's leader in oil pollution. Life expectancy in many rural areas with oil-polluted water has fallen to less than 40 years of age since the oil boom started in the early 1970s.
Well, DNA is natural. It's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one depended on another, and so the circle had closed up tight. But then along came a man in a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor, cows they grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray and our genetically modified world.
On the 10th of June, three customers of a puppy punching beagle killing research laboratory called Huntington Life Sciences received protests at their Washington, D.C. lobbying offices. Novartis, AstraZeneca, and Sanofi Aventis.
Here's what happens inside Huntington Life Sciences.
Oh, fucking get still.
Here's what happens with no body. AstraZeneca, no diabetic, who exists with Huntington Life Sciences.
Until they become one of DC's top ex-Huntington Life Sciences customers, protesters say they'll just keep coming back. Because in DC, there's no sleep for the wicked.
Your name?
Jamie Raskin. I'm the state senator for Silver Spring and Tacoma Park, and I'm a law professor at American University.
Can you talk about the situation with Purdue, the chicken factory company, and what's going on with the University of Maryland Law School Clinic?
Well, the Maryland Clinic has brought a clean water lawsuit on the Eastern Shore where the poultry industry has been responsible for the toxic contamination of a lot of the water table and through chicken waste has been contributing a lot to the degradation of the Chesapeake Bay, the majority of which is now a dead zone. And we're making progress on the bay. But the agricultural runoff continues to be a major problem. So there was this lawsuit brought by the University of Maryland Clinic, and at the end of the session, I noticed that in the budget, somebody had tucked an amendment in there, essentially penalizing the University of Maryland Law School Clinic by threatening to take away $500,000 and imposing a whole collection of really onerous bureaucratic reporting requirements on them, essentially making them go back for 5 years and give detailed accounts and reports of all of their cases and what happened in their cases and so on, and just, you know, an intense volume of bureaucratic drudgery. When I began to ask around to find out what was going on, it was clear that this was in retaliation for the clean water lawsuit brought by the students and the professors at the Maryland Clinic against Frank Purdue and some of the big farming interests. So, I worked with Senator Frosch and some other pro-environment senators, and we stood up to this just very heavy-handed attempt at interfering with the lawyer-client relationship and interfering with academic freedom. And we were able to resist it. Since then, I've learned that these kinds of attacks on law school clinics have been taking place across the country. The Louisiana legislature cracked down on the Tulane Law School Clinic in a very similar episode where they brought an environmental lawsuit against a big company. And the corporations don't even bother asserting that the lawsuits are flawed in any way. I mean, if they're flawed, they'll be kicked out of court. They're not accusing anybody of engaging in lawyer misconduct. If they were, the judges would crack down on them. They're just saying, we don't want to have to deal with people asserting their rights and environmental claims against the power of the big corporations. So, you know, as in many other cases, we're trying to stand up for the public interest and the common good against corporate special interests.
I just wanted to focus on that point about if the lawsuits were frivolous, they would be thrown out. And so this law clinic was bringing to the attention of the state, and in many instances, the state, it seems, is not maybe doing all that it could be to enforce the 1996 Clean Water Act. So this law clinic, these students and the lawyers that are working with them were really bringing to the attention areas where Purdue was possibly breaking the law.
That's right. Well, look, the Maryland General Assembly spends a lot of time trying to pass environmental legislation to reverse the incredible damage that's taken place to the Chesapeake Bay. And, you know, a lot of that is trying to control the problem of agricultural pollution and runoff. A lot of it is working on the problem of stormwater. But the irony here is that while we're passing environmental legislation to try to move things forward on the environmental front, there was, at the same time, an effort to undercut litigation precisely to enforce environmental quality and environmental regulations. But we were able to stop it. We were able to get most of what they were trying to do pulled out of the Maryland budget. And so, you know, when we alerted the law schools and the public to what was going on, we were able to turn it around. But people have got to be aware that there is a concerted effort in a lot of parts of the country now to undermine the work of the law clinics, which has been central to public interest litigation.
Senator Raskin, while you're able to turn it around, didn't the University of Maryland Law School Clinic have to disclose all of their clients' names?
Originally, the amendment proposed that they would have to give a complete accounting and recital of all of their clients in all of their clinics. They have 15 different clinics. We were able to reduce it to just the environmental clinic with no cutoff in money and without going into absurd detail. So they will have to report the cases that they've brought. And again, you know, I have no objection to public information. All of that was public information anyway, but it was just an attempt essentially to harass them. And we should be celebrating the work of the University of Maryland Law School Clinic, which is one of the best law clinics in the country, rather than trying to savage their work, defund them, and undermine their critical support for environmental protection.
Senator Jamie Raskin, in preparation for this interview, I was looking at some stuff about you, and I was shocked to learn about how you came to the law. You watched your father as a very young person hauled away to jail, and that's what sparked an interest?
Well, he actually never went to jail. He was indicted in 1968 in a case called the Boston Five trial with Dr. Spock and William Sloan Coffin and two other people for conspiracy to aid and abet draft evasion. And my dad had written a statement called A Call to Resist Illegitimate Authority, which was essentially arguing that the war was being conducted in an illegal way and had not been declared by Congress. And he ended up being acquitted. He was the only one of the five originally acquitted, but all of the convictions eventually were reversed. But I was only 6 years old at the time. But it's what got my mind focused in a pretty serious way on law and the power of law and what law can do to real people. And I've tried to commit my career to putting law on the side of justice and on the side of civil liberty and civil rights.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure.